You think that that is alive only in 1859. In the BC Court of Appeal in the Chilcotin case, recently decided, and now it's like 2 years ago, the Court of Appeal in this province said the principle of discovery applies, therefore gives the Crown the right to occupy these lands legitimately under that particular thinking. Meanwhile, this doctrine has been discredited by the United Nations already, yet the court in this country continues to apply that standard in a fight by the Chilcotin people to have their title to their lands recognized. So that doctrine of discovery is a very contentious piece internationally, but it is at the very root to the finding of countries in the entire Americas. In Africa, that doctrine was applied in a different way, of course, but the same principle applied. So even Italy, for heaven's sakes, had a colony in Africa. And different European countries set up states on the African continent. So since after the end of the World War, largely, we've seen a period of decolonization happening. There's a very structured process of decolonization that is happening. And we see one of the great icons of that deconstruction was late Nelson Mandela, Bishop Desmond Tutu. You know, somehow we pay really strong attention to something that's going on somewhere else, but when indigenous peoples in this country are advocating for their right as self-determining peoples to exist and fair justice about the issue relating to their lands, people think, well, Indian people want more. You know, there's one little t-shirt that's really raised a lot of controversy lately, and I'm sure some of you know the one I'm talking about. It says, if you own land, thank an Indian. Really piss a lot of people off. But you know, in some ways there's some real truth to that. And we forget it, but it really is a stark reminder in a way, kind of poking somebody in the eye to say wake them up. Because there's a tendency to be, you know, I don't really know the word to use, but there's a sense of apathy, right? That exists. And you know, unless something like that comes up, or we're seeing an Oka in the early 1990s, we don't really realize it, that sense of justice. And this is not really trying to play any guilt trip on anyone. It's just like, we need to sort this out. We need to straighten it out. But we need to do it fairly, not on the terms and conditions set by the federal government or the provincial government. We got to sit down as equals and sort it out. Right now, in the northern part of this province, there's a massive potential development for liquefied natural gas. Governments, I've been to China. I've never been invited by any government to go to China. We've been going on our own, mostly to tell our story to the Chinese government officials and the Chinese business people that we're still here, we haven't gone anywhere. I've listened to government presentations over there and they said, we have 115 years of energy supply, natural gas in northern British Columbia. I'm thinking, geez, you know, like, okay, 115 years from now, what are we going to do when all of that's gone? What will happen to those generations to whom we have responsibilities? We need to take care of our people now for sure. But here's the question that I have. Where will most of the money that's generated from oil in northern Alberta and gas in northern British Columbia, where would most of that go? It's not coming into our communities, I know that. I was in Norway. Norway, that small country, 5 million people, just a little more than this country's, this province's population. And they have a sovereign wealth fund. They've been developing the oil in the North Seas for I don't know how long now. But the sovereign wealth fund, their nest egg, is at $740 billion. They own 1% of the world's equity markets. They invest in the stock markets around the world, 1%. And they are allowed only to take 4% of whatever the money they generate to use for their social services in Norway. That little tiny country is $740 billion. So they're making sure that their peoples and their country benefit from the money that's being generated from the development of that resource. Alberta, where a lot of the oil comes from in this country, they run a $5 billion deficit a year. Figure that out. So in our case, as First Nations people, we really don't want to see that, because we have responsibilities to future generations. If we're going to take that resource and use it during our era or during our children's generation or grandchildren, we better make sure that we're looking into the future as well and not squandered away. So, you know, and I know we can all, many of us can read bottom lines. We know that the wealth generated goes to these huge international oil companies. That's where it's going. It's not really coming into our communities. You know, we create jobs and some businesses, but that foundation for the resource, for the foundation of that wealth creation comes the very resources, which is at the center of the dispute in the northern part of this province, northern Alberta. So this notion of free, prior, and informed consent is an important one. As soon as First Nations people say free, prior, and informed consent, what do you think the word is that comes into people's minds? Government. Well, you don't have a veto. Because they think it means a veto. Free, prior, and informed consent means we need to have the information ahead of time. We need to have the full suite of information, all of the necessary, pertinent, and relevant information to make a decision. We need to have that. That decision needs to be made before any development takes place, and that decision by the peoples must be free. There should be no coercion. Which means then there's a real challenge for our communities. How do we inform our people and ensure that they have the information necessary to make the decision? Free, prior, and informed consent. It applies in our communities when we are making decisions. So we need to make sure that everybody is informed, and we need to ensure that their wishes and their decisions are respected. And if they say no, the consent answer is no. And if they say yes, the consent answer is yes. And in some cases, it may be maybe, subject to maybe further clarification or whatever. But that's the ability of free citizens to make those decisions. And in a democratic country like this, I think it's really a good foundation for important democracies that the citizens are able to make decisions like free, prior, and informed consent means. There's a bit of that in slide number, you can see that in slide number 6, you know, there's a bit of, some of this document is over there too, by the way. That PowerPoint, and feel free to pick it up. What is the legal status? Canada says, well, you know, it's really only an aspirational document, the declaration. We think that it's more than that. It's as I said, international human rights standards put into this one instrument called the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. So It's been, we brought this issue before the Supreme Court of Canada on November 7th in the Chilcotin case that went before that pretty, that esteemed court. And we argued that these international instruments and the international standards ought to be taken into account. Canada is part of a nation, part of the United Nations made of 192 states. And when the 192 states agree to an instrument, some of it become like the Convention on the Rights of the Child I referred to earlier. It becomes part of the international legal norm, the international legal standards. In this case, we have a declaration